The United States locks up people at a higher rate than anywhere else in the world. Some of the most overcrowded prisons are in Alabama, and one of the worst is the Julia Tutwiler prison for women. It has also been under federal investigation for sex abuse by prison guards. Inmates at Tutwiler do have access to state-funded education programs. It offers GEDs and skills needed after release. Dan Carson of member station WBHM reports that classes that could keep inmates from returning to prison are now threatened by budget cuts.
And the great thing about winning your ball game is, just think it has to be a loser. Because it's just winners. Because when you win, everybody wins, right? Your kids win.
In a small classroom in Alabama's Julia Tutwiler prison compound, a dozen women sit at long gray tables. They all wear the same coarse white jumpsuits. A projector shows tips on responding to anger and developing a positive self-concept. 34-year-old Tamara Kirkwood reflects on her past.
You got this mentality, and you don't know how to change that way of thinking. You don't know how to get around that. All you know is, I don't have, and I need, and this is what's going to have to be done. And after so long, you think that's the way life is.
Kirkwood's in for drug charges, but she's taking a new life skills course offered by J.F. Ingram State Technical College.
As I began to think about the people that I knew, including relatives that have gone sideways with the law, what got them in trouble was not their ability or inability to do a job. What got them into a jam was their inability to manage their life.
That's J.F. Ingram President Hank Dassinger. He's a former Air Force marksmanship trainer with education and psychology degrees. Dassinger took over the 7-campus prison college 2 years ago and got the life skills classes started last year. 43-year-old Robin Myers is in Tutwiler for felony DUIs. She says she wishes the life skills classes were required for inmates.
Had I had someone teaching me the things that this program is teaching me 20 years ago, we would not be speaking at this moment. These classes take us step by step through thought processes, how we live, so that we can identify the steps where we're going wrong.
The problem is, there are only 2 people teaching this course at Tutwiler, a prison built for 400. It now holds roughly 700 inmates. Instead of getting more money, though, J.F. Ingram 2 years ago saw its budget slashed more than 12%.
And this year I'm facing another $20-something thousand cut. It makes a huge difference. In light of all of the evidence about the effectiveness of correctional education, how in the world do we cut the program that stands the best chance of getting people out of the overcrowded prison and into a situation where they won't come back?
It's very hard to justify an education program for prisoners when K through 12 doesn't have enough supplies.
That's Republican State Senator Cam Ward. He's become a leader on prison reform here in Alabama. He points to current budget realities, but he does see the benefits of prison education.
Studies have shown that those inmates who get involved in the educational component like J.F. Ingram offers, they're 43% less likely to come back in the system again. That number is astounding.
There's no hard data on how much Ingram's courses reduce recidivism, but a national study by the RAND Corporation out last year concludes prison education in general is dramatically effective. Lois Davis is the lead author.
It's a relatively low-cost program that has a huge return in terms of cost savings.
And cutting down on ballooning incarceration costs may persuade Alabama's conservative, tough-on-crime politicians to soften up a bit. Some are now talking about sentencing reform and about being, quote, smart on crime, which gives Ingram President Hank Dassinger some hope.
I think we're at a crossroads, and I think the nation is going to watch what we do, and are we going to be the Alabama of old? Are we going to really open ourselves up to new ways of thinking about a problem?
I have some fresh cantaloupe that I grew in my organic garden.
Convicted burglar Timothy Brown is thinking about a future outside. He's studying horticulture at another J.F. Ingram campus. He's got a life sentence, but he's hoping for parole soon.
I fell in love with organic gardening, and that's the medium that I want to try when I get out.
For NPR News, I'm Dan Carson in Birmingham, Alabama.
Students are heading back to campus, and when they finish that first paper of the year, a growing number will have to do something their parents never did, run their work through anti-plagiarism software. One company behind it is called Turnitin. And as Corey Turner of the NPR Ed Team reports, the database it uses to catch potential cheaters is big.
Really, really, really big.
Automatically, that paper gets
checked against about 45 billion web pages, 110 million content items from publishers, scientific journals, etc., and 400 million student papers to provide an originality report.
Chris Herrick is VP of marketing for Turnitin. He says the company is used by more than half of all higher ed institutions in the U.S. and by roughly a quarter of all high schools. They're not the only company doing this, but they are the biggest. Here's how it works. A student submits her paper through Turnitin's website. The company's algorithms then compare strings of text against its database. And as Herrick said, it doesn't just check the internet. Most of the papers, once they've been run through the system and scrubbed of student names, stay in the system. When all the comparing is done, the teacher gets a report that says,
this percentage of this paper matches the sources that we crawl and index in our databases.
The report never says, this is plagiarism, just, this is similar. And one complaint is that the service turns up false positives. The report color codes suspect passages and gives links to the material they matched, so a teacher can decide for herself, instead of the old way.
I would basically have to do Google searches.
Jennifer Schroeder teaches biology at Millikan University in Illinois, and she's embraced Turnitin in a big way. The reason?
I saw a lot of cases of students that just simply didn't know what to do.
It's not necessarily bad intent, it's just bad practices.
Tom Dee is a professor in the Graduate School of Education at Stanford. He also co-authored a study exploring why students plagiarize. When Dee's team gave students an early tutorial on what is and is not plagiarism,
we saw a substantial reduction in plagiarism.
He found lots of students simply don't understand the rules of proper citation. That's one reason Rebecca Moore Howard, a professor of writing and rhetoric at Syracuse University, is not a fan of Turnitin. Here's another reason.
The use of a plagiarism detecting service implicitly positions teachers and students in an adversarial position.
Howard says it's policing without probable cause.
The students have to prove themselves innocent before their work can be read and graded.
Stanford's Tom Dee also has this caution.
These tools are like a hammer or scalpel. Whether using them is helpful or hurtful depends on the care and discretion with which they're used.
For Jennifer Schroeder, the software is a scalpel. She asks her students to use Turnitin on rough drafts so they can learn from their mistakes. No penalty, no trip to the dean's office. But Emma Zabios, a senior at American University, says she had a professor who used Turnitin like a hammer against suspected plagiarists.
And would report them to the academic board, would attempt to have them expelled. He was very serious about it.
Plenty of plagiarism is intentional, though it's hard to know how much cheating is really happening. Many of the matches Turnitin finds come from paper mills, cheat sites, and its own paper database. And as the technology improves, some students intent on cheating will find ways to outsmart it. But with the company adding 300,000 student papers a day, intentional plagiarism is riskier than ever. So Zabios has some advice for students who find themselves in a cold sweat, deadline approaching, but no paper to show for it.
A zero will ruin your GPA, but it won't get you thrown out of school.
And you can quote her on that. Corey Turner, NPR News, Washington.
The minivans are loading up as many teenagers are heading off to college this week. On some campuses, students will hear lectures on how to avoid risky behavior. But a handful of colleges are assigning homework before students even get there. Some require students to complete online seminars about sexual assault, and others ask kids and parents to have frank discussions about how to prevent rape. Charlotte Albright reports on how one father and daughter tackled that topic before she left for the University of New Hampshire.
With classic red brick dorms and stately fraternity houses, UNH looks like an inviting home away from home. But like many universities, it's trying to curb sexual violence. An estimated 1 in 4 women and 1 in 10 men between the ages of 18 and 25 are sexually assaulted each year, and the vast majority of the perpetrators are known to the victims. So Maggie Wells from the Sexual Assault Prevention Center at UNH has emailed students with tips about how to talk with their parents before they leave home about a troubling topic, rape.
And we understand that it's a hard conversation. And when we sort of say to parents, you know, tips to talk about with your son or daughter about these issues before they come, you see like the deer in headlights.
But in Providence, Rhode Island, Kelly Reardon has little trouble sitting down in the kitchen with her father, Edward, a physician. Before she leaves for UNH, they have the talk and record it for this story on Kelly's smartphone.
College is approaching in about a week. And what would you say are the most important things to know before I go off to college in terms of consent and assault and rape?
I would say the most important things to know is to anticipate a situation before you get into it. Always travel with friends. Have a planned evening of activities, a daytime activities. Avoid isolation. Avoid substances.
Kelly, her father reminds her, has very little experience with drugs or alcohol.
And that's where I see you as being very vulnerable in these frat parties and this all this ha-ha bullshit stuff with these males. Just be careful and back away.
Kelly assures her dad that she feels prepared for whatever college life throws at her, and she figures this little kitchen table chat will be followed by conversations and presentations on campus about sex with college advisors throughout the year.
They will definitely help me. How do you feel like UNH will help me?
I like the fact that they're not afraid to talk about unpleasantness.
UNH officials say it's surprising how many students arrive on campus without ever talking to anyone about what Edward Reardon euphemistically calls the unpleasantness of assault. That's why they're trying to reach students before the drinking games start. But even the people promoting these early prevention measures aren't sure they'll make a big difference. Jane Stapleton is a researcher at UNH, and she's conducting a study for a White House task force about how best to educate students before they arrive about how to prevent or report sexual violence. Research does show, she says, that crimes like that are most likely to happen when a predator targets an unsuspecting young student early in the term.
These are perpetrators who very much sort of blend into the college culture.
Stapleton says those criminals make up only about 4% of a typical college population, but they often commit more than one sex crime. That's why, over the next 4 years, students like Kelly Reardon are likely to keep hearing from older peers, faculty, administrators, and yes, parents on cell phones about staying safe while having fun. For NPR News, I'm Charlotte Albright.
More than 70 colleges in the United States are under investigation for how they handled sexual assault cases. Now, the problem of campus sexual assault is surely as old as the campus itself, but there are reasons it's getting more attention now. Student activists have helped to push the issue into the spotlight. NPR's Jennifer Ludden continues our ongoing series.
Georgetown University orientation this week. A rousing welcome for freshmen. But after the big stage show, there's a new activity. For the first time this year, students are required to break into small groups and talk about sexual assault.
Hi, you can come on in, take a seat anywhere that's open.
Georgetown junior Chandini Jha is one of the students who will guide a discussion, intimate, frank, private. She's been pushing administrators to do this for 2 years.
For a lot of the kids, this might be the first time they ever actually talk about sexual assault or what consent means in an environment with their peers.
Georgetown is not being investigated on this issue, but Jha says the problem is a national epidemic. About 1 in 5 women are sexually assaulted in college, as are some men. She's active beyond her own campus, part of a group using social media to spread the word. Schools are bound to try to protect students from sexual assault under a federal law called Title IX.
Our goal is to get this critical mass of students educated about it, almost as like a check against universities violating Title IX, but also just to help empower students who have been in those situations on the things that they can ask for their universities to do.
It's just the kind of information Dana Bolger wishes she had back in 2011 when she was raped her sophomore year at Amherst.
My dean encouraged me to take time off, go home, essentially wait for my rapist to graduate and then come back to campus when it was safe to do so.
Bolger did drop out for a bit, Then she joined a support group and found out she wasn't the only one who felt mistreated by her college. She and others demanded meetings with Amherst officials, a list of reforms in hand, and got nowhere.
But for a survivor who has to study in the same library as her assailant, or a survivor that has to eat in the same dining hall as his rapist, urgency is real.
So in 2012, they went public. The student paper posted one woman's searing account of her rape.
Angie Epifano was able to tell her story in the Amherst Student, and the next day there were thousands and thousands of views. I don't know what that possibly could have looked like in the 1970s.
The response was electric. The college president reached out to Epifano and announced reforms. Suddenly, sexual assault victims across the country were seeking each other out online. After finishing her degree, Bolger helped create Know Your Nine to educate students about their rights.
Hi.
In her sunny, bare-bones apartment in Washington, D.C., Bolger Skypes with co-founder Alexandra Brodsky at Yale.
Did you get a chance to look at the Action Network?
Yes.
Their group has a growing network of campus activists, including Chandani Jha at Georgetown. They connect assault survivors to pro bono attorneys. They staged protests at the U.S. Department of Education. That led to meetings with White House officials and members of Congress. Such high-profile events have put these activists in the spotlight. But outside that, other students continue to act, sometimes on their own.
I created a website that maps the data from the daily crime log.
Guillermo Rojas is in his last semester at Dartmouth, one of the schools under investigation for its handling of sexual assault. By law, schools are required to keep a public tally of campus crimes, including sexual assault. But unlike many, Dartmouth doesn't put it online. A few weeks ago, Rojas decided to do it himself.
The college refuses to provide emailed spreadsheets and refuses to let us take pictures.
So he goes over to the Department of Safety and Security and types the data into his laptop.
I always feel like a nuisance. I get the sense that not a lot of people ask for it.
It's just morally reprehensible that administrators are putting the burden of fixing the problems onto students like that.
Susie Strubel is a Dartmouth alum, class of 93, and she was raped on campus. Strubel's thrilled with activists like Rojas, though worries it won't be enough. Students, she says, graduate.
College administrators know this. They know that if they can just hunker down and weather a crisis, that group of students is going to graduate sooner or later. But alumni are always around. We have a lot of influence. We have a lot of money. We still have a lot of say in what kind of culture we have on our campuses.
Strubel's helped found two alumni groups to keep up the pressure. In Washington, D.C., Dana Bolger agrees that's key. Not yet a year out of college, she's quit a job to devote herself full-time to Know Your Nine. She says it's great the federal government has tightened the rules on how schools should handle sexual assault.
But at the end of the day, what we need is enforcement. Schools are operating today knowing that the department has never once sanctioned a school for these violations and with very little expectation that they will ever do so in the future.
Bolger can imagine a career holding them to account. Among the other ambitious items on her to-do list, law school. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.